This week on Making Contact.
What's going on, I think, in New Orleans should be the litmus test for the civil rights and human rights battle.
Who will rebuild New Orleans? 1 year after Hurricane Katrina's floodwaters nearly destroyed the region, virtually nothing has been done to reconstruct the Crescent City. Inaction from local authorities, almost zero commitment from the federal government, material shortages, and labor fraud. All have added up to a crisis of stagnation and desperation for residents trying to reestablish their lives. Yet rebuilding must happen, but who will do the building? Some say a new union movement is the answer, and we'll hear why. I'm Tina Rubio, your host for Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. In 1906, this nation mobilized to rescue, rebuild, and restore the earthquake-devastated city of San Francisco. A century later, in 2006, 1 year after Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast, residents are still waiting for that reconstruction to begin. And why is that? Steve Seltzer, founder of Labor Video Project, Cece Campbell Rock, veteran journalist, and Raymond Rock, community organizer, both displaced by Hurricane Katrina, share their collective analysis and vision for rebuilding New Orleans based on a revived unionization of Reconstruction workforces. These are excerpts from their speeches at Labor Fest 2006 in San Francisco.
In 1906, of course, you didn't have telephones. All you had was telegraphs at that time. But right after the San Francisco earthquake, it happened the morning of April the 18th, the Congress, the U.S. Congress, met at 4 o'clock in the morning. They had a special session of Congress, and they voted to make an all-out national effort to rebuild San Francisco. They ordered the U.S. Army to send every tent that they had to San Francisco to house people. They had a national mobilization. They had trains loaded with food coming from all over the United States to San Francisco to help the survivors of the earthquake in San Francisco. And also, the insurance companies in that period were forced, in California, they were forced to pay the people that owed money on their insurance on their homes. So there was a national effort, a national mobilization to support the people of San Francisco, not only national, international. Japan spent $250,000. There were collections all over the world for the people of San Francisco. And I think we have to counterpose that to the reaction to Katrina and to New Orleans, because despite the fact that the United States has the biggest military in the world, it has jets, it has helicopters, it has a massive military apparatus, they could not provide food and supplies and water to the people of New Orleans. You have to ask, why? Why? Why 100 years ago was the United States able to mobilize the country and help the people of San Francisco so no one went hungry, no one starved? They rebuilt the city in 3 years. Primarily, San Francisco was built despite the massive destruction, 24,000 homes, massive destruction in San Francisco. It was rebuilt in 3 years. And yet we have Katrina, New Orleans, and the Gulf Coast, and what is happening today. And one important point to know about New Orleans is that nationally, the national government wants to destroy the working class and the black working class in New Orleans. They have said they're going to shut down the schools. They laid off thousands of teachers, and they privatized the schools, and they say you can only open up a private school. We're only going to provide money for a private school. They got rid of prevailing wage, Bush did, and changed that. So they want to destroy the working class. They don't want strong unions. They don't want the workers organized. Now, at the Change to Win convention, organizing convention, they promised that there was going to be big organizing in New Orleans, that all the unions were going to set up shops, and the unions have collected millions of dollars. My union, the operating engineers, collected $3-4 million for their members. But they said they were going to train hotel and restaurant workers. They were going to train construction workers, the laborers. They made all kinds of promises. But unfortunately, like Tracy Washington, there's an attorney there. She spoke at Stanford recently, and she said she hasn't seen those unions. Mm-hmm. Now, we know the unions are under attack all over in this country and in San Francisco. We just saw that with Local 2. But when you make a promise to the people of New Orleans, which offers the opportunity to organize the South, that's what we're talking about.
Right.
We're talking about organizing the entire South. That is the potential.
Yeah.
And that's where the union should be putting these hundreds of millions of dollars into organizing and getting people to join unions in the South. So with that, I want to turn it over to our speakers, and thank you very much for attending tonight.
First of all, I'm Cece Campbell Rock, and this is my husband, Raymond Anthony Rock III. And we're New Orleanians, and we have come to the Bay Area by way of an older son who's lived in Pleasanton for 15 years. I left the day before the storm hit Katrina, and she really didn't hit New Orleans, but he'll tell you a little more about that. He stayed behind about, 14 days, 10 days, and so he went through the whole issue. But the bottom line in all of this, since the Army Corps of Engineers, since the New Orleans Levee Board didn't do their job and allowed the levees to get in such a deplorable condition that the water broke through and just ruined our lives and took everything away from us, then they have to pay for that. And that's just the bottom line. Every mother will tell you if their child's in a china shop and acts like a bull and breaks the china, we have to pay for the china. So I look at New Orleans. New Orleans has a right to work law, by the way. It means a right to fire you and hire you. We have one union that was at one hotel, and that's the Fairmont Hotel. Of all the hotels and multinationals we have, you know, the unions are not yet unionized. I mean, the hotels are not yet unionized. At least up here, you guys have got a good start. But it's certainly a plantation economy. It's certainly a plantation-minded people. And you may say, well, you know, everybody in leadership in New Orleans are African Americans. We're African Americans, the most Africanized city in the United States. Yes. But if you know anything about history, you know there were house Negroes and there were field Negroes. And the house Negroes were, I call them the Creole ruling class, were just running everything, and they, whatever the master said, they did. So they sold us out. And so now today you have rich developers running in and feeding off us like buzzards. And matter of fact, our own mayor is sanctioning that. There are land developers on his Bring New Orleans Back commission that has nothing to do with bringing us back, but maybe bringing back the wealthy people. And I think you all heard that despicable Baker comment, Congressman Baker, and I forget whatever little small rural place is. He is what we couldn't do, God did, in running out people from public housing. So you heard Richard Baker's comments, you know, and he had
River, Louisiana.
Oh, he had eminent domain running all up and down the bill that he tried to put forth into Congress, and I'm glad it didn't survive. But we see remnants in Kathleen Babineau Blanco's Louisiana Road Home Program that's supposed to help homeowners. But in fact, it bites off this amount. If you had insurance, they're gonna deduct that. If FEMA gave you something, you'll deduct that. $150,000 for our lives, that's what we're worth. For a whole family of four, okay? And when they finished splitting off what they gave, you know, what FEMA gave us and what our insurance company gave us, what are we gonna rebuild with? Then I read in the paper today that FEMA's decided, oh, from now on, if there's a disaster at the Sacramento River or in Sonoma County, and anywhere, you're only gonna get $500 per family. Now, what can you do with that? You can't even buy toilet tissue with that, come on. I mean, because of the fraud. No, the fraud was with Halliburton. The fraud was with not coming to rescue people and letting 1,800 people die before you even brought across the bread. And of course, it's skin politics. It had to do, everything to do with classism and racism. And it is alive and well in New Orleans and Louisiana, and the battle has yet to be fought. So I'm so glad to see you guys are here, because one of those things that's critical is to have a voice. But I'll let my husband speak to the issue of his experience, but also labor, because he is a carpenter, and he went back there in October to do some work, to find work, and I'll let him explain the labor situation and what he sees as a solution. But it's not over. Katrina's not over for us. It's not over for you guys. If today or tomorrow you have an earthquake or a flood, have mercy on you, because government will not be there. Trust me.
Mm-hmm.
I am a union man. I come from union families, family. My first opportunity to join a union was working with NASA in New Orleans with Michoud. We was working on the space shuttle program with the liquid nitrogen, hydrogen. I was very active, involved. We walked out because of the difference in money that we were getting as opposed to other places in the United States. They quickly settled that that grievance. Also, I worked with the post office union for 13 years. And also, I was involved with the Housing Authority of New Orleans. We weren't unionized, but I made sure that my men that I hired got paid like union. We didn't have the benefits, but we at least we were making halfway decent money at that time. I'm talking about 1980, 85. I want to talk about unions because unions are critical in today's environment and in what we're trying to do all over the United States. New Orleans is a time bomb. We're either gonna go up in flames. Are we going to build one of the most beautiful cities that the world have ever seen? I think that unions have a golden opportunity to come down and to train our young men, our young women of all nationalities, and provide some hope and some opportunities. We've been talking about this for a long time. The unions, we have different unions in the city, but as far as the trades, I mean, they're almost non-existent. They have a location, they have an office, but they're almost non-existent. And it's really, really a shame because we have some of the, I mean, you could pick guys up off the street, and I mean, I've done that. And you know, before you know it, they know how to read the rule, they could measure, they can, you know, do basic carpentry, you know, and we've been emphasizing that for a long, long time. I don't know what's, you know, why our union people can't see this. I mean, it's a golden opportunity right now. I mean, because if we can get in there as union people and train, you know, a workforce, because we need an army of people working in New Orleans, making good salaries, good benefits, so on and so forth. That's not happening. The mayor, as my wife said, is sitting on his hands. He's waiting for the people to come in and decide, well, this is what I want to do, this is what I want to do, and everybody's going in 500 different directions. Nothing is getting done. Oh, yeah, well, you know, they brought a lot of Hispanic people in New Orleans. I mean, they didn't have to bring them in. They, you know, once the word was out, I mean, they saw the opportunity. And you can't blame folks for trying to, you know, everybody's looking for a decent wage. Everybody want their families to have a decent way of life. I mean, that's the bottom line on all of this. And what they were doing, they were getting these guys and they weren't paying them. You know, they'd pick them off the street. And they basically, you know, these guys are living in cars, sleeping in cars and on the side of buildings and so on. And that's a major problem right now in New Orleans. I understand there's like something like 100,000 Hispanic people right now from different parts of South America has come into New Orleans. And even at that, we're still not getting anything done. Halliburton, Brown and Ruth came in with no bid contracts. I mean, they came in rolling. You know, they did a lot of work. You know, they did a lot of work, but it's non-union jobs. Again, you know, so I'm looking for some help. You know, I'm looking for some help from the union. How are we gonna build New Orleans? You know, and I mean, these are the questions that are not being answered. So I'm here tonight. We need your help. We need the support of the unions. We need for the unions to come in to set up training facilities, to teach our young people, give them an opportunity to do better, to make something out of their lives. I mean, The unions for a long time neglected the needs of African American people. That's a historical fact. I mean, they did not want us in the unions way back in the game and even today. I remember coming up, we were not allowed to join any type of unions. We couldn't get certifications or licensed electricians or plumbers or carpenters or anything else. So it's a new day. At least I hope it is. It's a new day, and we got to find a new way. And we can't be afraid. Do not be afraid.
That was Raymond Rock. He's a community organizer. You also heard his wife, Cece Campbell Rock. She's a journalist. The two of them were displaced by Hurricane Katrina. And you also heard Steve Seltzer, the founder of Labor Video Project. They were speaking at Labor Fest 2006. We'll have more in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information, or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. Eric Mann is director of the Labor Community Strategy Center, a think tank based in Los Angeles. He's an author and a civil rights, environmental, and labor activist. His most recent book is Katrina's Legacy: White Racism and Black Reconstruction in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. Making Contact spoke with Mann about the need for an active social movement for the reconstruction of New Orleans.
The groups I talked to were the People's Hurricane Relief Fund, Communities Labor United, ACORN, Families and Friends of Louisiana's Incarcerated Children, Jordan Flaherty, who's an independent journalist with Left Turn magazine. And here was the problem. The problem was that unless there was a national movement led by a Martin Luther King, led by a Malcolm X, unless there was a congressional black caucus that would really take on the Democratic Party, unless there was a Democratic Party that was ready to take on the Republican Party, unless there was a movement at the bottom that was militant, revolutionary, and had deep ties to the masses, we were in grave, grave danger. And the reality is the movement in New Orleans was not that strong before Katrina. It was divided before Katrina. But then again, the movement in Los Angeles is not that strong. It is divided before the hurricane, the earthquake that we may get. The movement in Atlanta or the movement in Chicago is weak and divided. So if that's the state of the national movement, divided by race, divided by ideology, divided by an absence of what we call united front culture, then we have to understand that the storm plus the right wing are far, far stronger than the movement that's trying to reverse it.
We asked Mann specifically about the role of unions, race, and class in his analysis of post-Katrina New Orleans.
Fundamentally, the AFL-CIO is not just a weak force, but it's often a treacherous force. You have to remember the AFL-CIO was built a lot through the Cold War. It was built through the defeat of the communists after World War II. Most of the people who came to power in the AFL-CIO are very close to the companies. They are, some of them ride on their corporate jet, but more importantly, they ideologically have very little difference with the companies. So, and they have no difference whatsoever with the Democratic Party, as any doormat would have no difference with the feet that are walking on it. So in that the unions have been the doormat of the Democratic Party and all they do is raise money to elect Democrats, what did they expect after Katrina? In my book, there's a very interesting debate with a guy named Lewis Rain, who's the head of the AFL-CIO in Louisiana. And in Katrina's Legacy, I ask him, well, you had a march the other day. Don't you think the biggest issue is black people and the black right of return to New Orleans? You didn't mention anything about racism, Lewis. You didn't mention anything about black people returning to New Orleans. You didn't talk about civil rights. You didn't talk about white racism. And he said in the interview, in my book, you're right. No, I did not. I do not think hurricanes understand race. I don't think hurricanes understand class. They just wipe out everybody in their midst. And this is, whether you're rich or poor, we all suffer from a hurricane. Now I'm thinking, are you kidding me? Are you really hallucinating? Rich or poor? First of all, in New Orleans, the ground in New Orleans, I wrote a book, an article for World Watch magazine called Race and the Higher Ground in New Orleans. And what you've seen is that in the higher areas of elevation in New Orleans, they're overwhelmingly white. And as we start moving down to sea level, it gets about mixed. And as you get down below sea level, it's 90 to 95% black. So what does that say? Hurricanes don't know race? Maybe hurricanes don't know race, but the physical structure of the city knows race because the poorest of the poor and the blackest of the black have been forced to live in the areas that are most vulnerable, where they would know that in the wake of a hurricane, they would be the ones most likely to be hurt, killed, displaced, dismembered, and driven out of their homeland.
According to Mann, the historical roots are deep on the question of minority rights in this country, spanning several quote-unquote revolutions.
Now, part of the book, Katrina's Legacy, White Racism and Black Reconstruction in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, is a history lesson. It's really about a 70-page run-through, very briefly, of U.S. history from a black perspective, U.S. history on what we call the black-white contradiction. So the first part of the story begins at the end of slavery in 1865 and describes a rather amazing period in U.S. history from 1865 to 1877 in which freed black slaves actually had self-government. Some were elected to the U.S. Senate, if you can imagine this. Some were elected to Congress. But for a moment, they were not subject to the complete violence of the Ku Klux Klan and the Southern plantation owners. By 1877, that period was over. The Klan was in the ascendancy. Jim Crow had been passed. The Black Codes had been passed. So from 1877 to 1953, which is just arbitrary, was the period of what I call the first counter-revolution against the first Reconstruction. In 1954, Brown versus Board of Education, 55, the Montgomery bus boycott, 55, the Bandung Conference of Non-Aligned Nations, 54 and 55, the defeat of the French in Dien Bien Phu in North Vietnam. There was this period of rising black liberation as part of a rising third world liberation. That amazing period that I was lucky enough to be lived through and be shaped by took place from 1954 to ballpark 1975 with the victory of the Vietnamese driving out the United States. By 1980, we have the rise of Ronald Reagan, followed by the rise of George Bush Sr., followed by the reactionary Bill Clinton. And in my book, I point out that Clinton and Gore were a continuation of the second counter-revolution. They did not reverse it. They made no effort to reverse it. They got rid of welfare as we know it. They passed, I don't know if you've heard, the first effective death penalty and anti-terrorist bill. Was not passed by Bush or Reagan, it was passed by Bill Clinton. So we now are living in 26 or 27 years of what we call the second counter-revolution. And the hopeful part of my book is it says from 2005 at Katrina, we are going to try to make Katrina the beginning of a third reconstruction. That third reconstruction would focus on black and Latino rights. It would focus on supporting Hugo Chavez's right to self-determination. It would not support overturning Fidel Castro in Cuba. It would end the war in Iraq. It would end the war in Lebanon that the Israelis have initiated. It would call for a very third world national liberation perspective on politics in the United States and politics in the world. Because a third reconstruction gets you beyond saying I'm doing immigrant rights, I'm doing gay and lesbian rights, I'm doing workers' rights, union rights, black rights, Latino rights. It begins to say, yes, you're doing all those things, but what's the frame? Is there a revolutionary frame that we can all feel that we're part of an anti-racist, anti-imperialist movement?
Mann says that without economic security and a living wage, social upheaval remains a viable option for underserved communities.
In 1992, during the urban rebellion in Los Angeles, I was rather taken aback to see the corporate forces that came in and that were saying to the community, you don't need those failed social programs, those parentheses, failed social programs that we killed, programs that we cut, programs that they failed to get you out of poverty because we never had enough income for you, because we never had the low-income housing maintained at the proper level, because we never gave you medical and mental treatment, because we drove you out of the mental hospitals onto the street. So the myth of the failed social programs should be called the killed social programs that the right did. But they, you know, ideology is a powerful and dangerous thing. If you keep repeating to poor people, you don't want to be in a culture of poverty, you don't want to be a welfare queen, you know, no, I don't. But compared to what? So that was the backdrop to the urban rebellion in 1992, and now it's the backdrop to the disgusting corporate makeover of New Orleans in 2005, 2006, and beyond. What happened is that New Orleans was always run by a tiny corporate elite. It was fundamentally a port with gambling casinos, with Mardi Gras, with tourism, and with a ton of poor people hanging on by a thread. In this case, of the poor, 84% of the poor were black. So when Katrina happened, it was not just ethnic cleansing that people were looking for, but class slash race slash gender cleansing. Let's get rid of 250,000 of the poorest black and mostly women who we don't have jobs for and we don't want to give government programs for. So in the book Katrina's Legacy, there's a whole section called The Social Welfare State, Not the Police State, where the social welfare state must trump the private sector. Because my argument is that if the United States got out of Iraq, if the United States seriously took away the $5 billion in aid that they're giving to Israel, if the United States cut all the grotesque slush funds that the $400 billion defense budget has become, if they built first-class public housing, low-rise, mixed-use, Section 8, but also collective public housing that people would have ownership rights to, how's that for a concept? That people would rent for 10 years and over the time have, like, build public housing into a condo. And if there was collective black land, if there were parks, if they rebuilt the electricity, all that would take a ton of work. And the concept would be that if a society does not have work at a living wage, if it does not have a good public school system, if it does not have parks for you, if it does not have drug treatment programs for you, its obligation is to get them. Your obligation is to revolt and rise up until you get them.
That was Eric Mann, author of Katrina's Legacy, White Racism and Black Reconstruction in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to mixing engineer Philip Babbage, to Dan Turner, Ronald Rucker, and Steve Macer. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. For a CD copy of program number 3506, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. Or go to radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Dorian Taylor, communications manager, and Stefana Petrova, production intern. And I'm your host and senior producer, Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.